Across the city and South Cambridgeshire.
On FM, digital and your mobile.
Cambridge 105 Radio.
The time is right for this sort of thing.
Food is everything.
Cambridge is right for this sort of thing.
What's it like? Condicious.
Good afternoon and happy new year and welcome to Flavour 2020. Thanks to Ollie for the Cambridgeshire Football Show, and now we are going to bring you some food and drink. I am Matt Bentman, and here live in the studio with me today is Alan Alder and Sue Bailey.
And it's good to be back. Today we're looking at some of these stories we covered in 2019. We'll take a look at some of the cafes and restaurants we featured, some of the food writing, some of the community endeavours, and we'll remind ourselves too of some of the food and drink providers in and around Cambridge.
And we've plenty to choose from. This year we had 125 features and 25 news briefings, and it's been good looking back at all of them to prepare for this retrospective. Let's begin with cafes and restaurants.
Yeah, there's been some really good new independents next year. It doesn't stop. Provenance Kitchen opened Bricks and Mortar in Whittlesford. Scott Holden opened Scott's All Day in Mill Road. There's Little Petra, also in Mill Road. And of course, Vanderlyle in Mill Road.
Yeah, and also in Mill Road is Modigliani. The cafe there opened too. And in terms of empire building, Thirsty opened its new site with Thirsty and Hungry on King Street. And other expansions include Tradizione Sorrento. That's the original Tradizione, is also on Mill Road. The pizza place. So Tradizione Sorrento is on Cherry Hinton Road. And there's also the Dumpling Tree, which has moved to Pern Road in a much larger site. There was also La Piazza, which is a second site from Signorelli's Deli, and the Calverley's Brewery Boys told us of their plans at the end of the year to open a new place on Chesterton Road.
But there have been closures of several well-known chains too. The mid-market restaurant scene is struggling, so it's especially good to hear and to see that the indie scene seems to be thriving. Let's start with Tristan Welch of Parker's Tavern and his view of the demise of Jamie Oliver's empire, and then on chains in general.
He started off with the best intentions, he was true to his word, he put his money where his mouth was. But, you know, failures happen to the best of us, and I'm sure he will rise from the ashes stronger and better.
But, I mean, it is part of a pattern, isn't it? I mean, Carluccio, Strada, Cow,
yep.
Various places. I mean, is there a deeper problem?
Yeah, there's a massive problem, and I believe chain restaurants and the mid-market are really killing the industry. They're de-skilling the industry.
In what way?
Well, a large percentage of their food is prepared off-site. We're quite novel here. We make our mashed potato fresh. But now it's cheaper and easier to buy frozen nuggets of mashed potato. And that's de-skilling the industry. It's horrendous. It's not nutritious. It's nowhere near as good. But people are settling for it, or they were settling for it, and now obviously they're voting with their feet and their mouths and everything. They're not going to these restaurants as much. I believe chains have tried to trivialise the fun of eating out. They've made it too regular, too easy. By trying to make too much money out of something which is a low margin business, they're probably killing themselves a bit. And there's restaurants out there, these chains, which will pay £250,000 per year in the rent. What sort of restaurant do you want to sit in that's paying £250,000 in rent? How much money is actually going into that food? And what are you putting into your bodies when you eat that? What sort of quality is that? Yeah, it raises so many questions, it's unbelievable. So I can see why some of them are sinking. It's Jamie's I'm incredibly sad about.
Now let's hear Alex Rushmer and Lawrence Butler talking about menus at Vanderlyle, and then Scott Holden of Scott's All Day on the agonies involved in opening a new independent.
Where do you get your inspiration from?
Oh, a mixture of things, really. We're drawing influences from all over, really. Alex is an avid reader, and I'm an avid eater, so between the two of us, we have a lot of thoughts to discuss.
How far in advance do you plan the menu?
I'd like to say that it was a fairly organised process, but that would be something of an untruth. Mm. The menu is relatively stable, but we're small enough that we're able to respond very quickly to changes in produce, or we might get a call from a supplier to say that we've got a glut of tomatoes in, and we'll change the menu depending on that. But generally, the menu is fixed for us for a week. We change one or two dishes a week. We aim to change the whole menu over the course of a month.
Do you use organic produce mainly?
We haven't been dogmatic about anything that we cook. We're not even dogmatic about the fact that we just cook vegetables. We just happen to be cooking vegetables at the moment. Whether it's coincidence or by design, the best vegetables that we can get our hands on are locally grown and organic. We use the majority of what we put on the menu comes from Flourish Produce in Hildesheim, a truly inspirational farm only eight or so miles from the restaurant.
About as organic as you can possibly get.
And we've paid several visits there, and every time we go, it is a source of just amazing inspiration. And the produce is next level. It's the best produce. It really is the best produce that we can get our hands on. And what matters to us most is sustainability, and I think that's very, very closely linked with organic farming and organic farming practices, or not even necessarily certified organic, but people who are following organic methods without the certification. I think all these things are, they've almost become incidental to us because we take them for granted, I suppose. Instead of the menu being chef-driven and us saying, okay, well, we want to put aubergines on the menu, it's much more in line with what is available to us at this particular moment in time.
And also, you don't follow any particular cuisine of any particular, you know, sort of Ottolenghi style or anything like that.
Do you know, I've been thinking about this for quite a lot recently. There's an awful lot of Italian influences in what we do. We're not too hung up on technique. We're much more about use our menu as a showcase for what people are growing locally, rather than hiding it in lots of, you know, cream sauces and overly reduced and overly complicated preparations. That's not to say we don't take a lot of effort in what we do. I'm just looking at the menu now. We have a salad on. The first course that we do is a salad. And tonight it's 32 different ingredients in the salad. So that's as a good example of what we do. And that takes time to... Some of it is raw, some of it is cooked, some of it is braised, some of it is foraged, some of it is super fresh. And, you know, it all comes into the restaurant. It all has to be washed and prepped and carefully assembled and kept in perfect conditions. So there's a huge amount of work just in that one dish, but we find it enormously satisfying and a really good, a really good snapshot of what is available and what is absolutely spectacular on this particular day.
And now, Scott of Scott's All Day.
We're very much an all-day affair, so you start in the morning for brunch and then lunch and then sourdough pizza in the evenings, kind of going for a kind of very high standard of food and high quality of ingredients, and kind of just doing a little bit of a different brunch than what you can find on the road as well. Soon we're doing more of a filling brunch, I'd say, so you can get a full English breakfast, so to speak, which uses all Mill Road Butcher's ingredients, and some kind of Middle Eastern dishes like a shakshuka, which has poached eggs in, and kind of going back to some American roots, a sausage patty and a muffin. We were very, very busy this week, and it was very, very fun, very good feedback and positive. So
yeah, because you've only been open a couple of weeks or so, haven't you?
Yes, it was our third weekend and second week of trade, so to see that kind of level of busyness was very, very promising. But I'm really looking forward to autumn and winter when it gets a bit dark outside earlier and people really be able to see inside as they're walking down the street.
But when you're starting up a business and you've got all the expense of doing the refurbishment of the building, buying in the ovens and so on, hiring people who can't be paid immediately, how does it feel? I mean, do you, and especially if the building works drag on, how does it make you feel? Do you start feeling tense?
Very anxious and very tense. It's not obviously all of my money, it's my family's money as well, and the other investors as well. But having seen the reason we chose this spot is because it's a busy crossroads and we know that it's going to have the footfall in order to fill the space, which should generate enough money to start paying that back. We hope it does anyway. And also having a lot of experience working in restaurants and just seeing over time, when you, as long as you do everything that you say you're going to do, and then you should get people to come back.
And are you getting people to come back, or is it too soon to know?
No, we've already, especially on the weekends, we've had people coming in for brunch and then coming in for sourdough pizza at night time because they enjoyed it so much. So that was really, really nice to get that. And people that came for brunch last week came again this week. So, yeah.
So is the anxiety starting to dissipate now?
No.
Oh, right.
No, I'm sure it will do soon. We're still in the very, very early phase and just...
Yeah, we were pretty surprised and delighted to hear that one of the flavour team provided the inspiration for a favourite at Parker's Tavern. So, here is Tristan Welch again.
So it's one of those desserts that really excite me. It's all about the ratio of caramel versus custard. And to think it was invented here in Cambridge and Trinity College just is really exciting. It's a bit of food heritage.
But the French might say it's theirs.
Yeah. I love a bit of controversy, and I'm happy to agree to disagree with the French. A cultural history of gastronomic heights, the least they could do is just give us one little creme brulee, you know?
Exactly.
One little creme brulee. Yes,
and call it Trinity Burnt Cream.
Yeah, exactly. Come on. But actually, I do like to wind up some of our French employees a little bit. And it's all light-hearted and good fun, actually.
You've got a recipe for it dating back to 1740. What book was that in? Is this one of your collection?
Gosh, I can't remember. I would have to go back and look. I do have an antique book collection. It's been a real passion of mine for so long, because I always think to look forward you have to look back, and I always find it so exciting to see what was cooked and all that sort of stuff. Pre-Victorian era, and actually when the Victorians streamlined it as well, was really interesting as well on that. But yes, yeah, it's a real passion of mine.
Yeah, it's a passion of mine too.
Oh, I know. Do you know what? I think you're way more qualified than me. I'm just a mild voyeur of the world of food history.
So, how big is your food history book collection?
Oh, it's 3 bookcases.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, it started from a young age, actually. I remember the antique cookbook shops in North Norfolk. They're still there, but they're way more expensive now than they used to be. So for 20 pence, I could get an antique cookbook. For a quid, they'd give me 6, you know? So I got really excited. And then just as time went on, I would collect from relatives and things like that. You know, I find Mrs. Beaton's really interesting. And I love that sort of, that series that kind of... a bit of history of Mrs. Beaton as well, and it explained a lot of things, you know.
Yeah.
But also, you know, things like British recipes for macaroni and macaroni pie. We were great importers and all this sort of stuff. Very, very exciting. And in fact, Duke of Cambridge tart as well.
Yes.
Now, if I saw you on your website, I believe, a bit about Duke of Cambridge tarts, and that inspired me to recreate Duke of Cambridge tart here.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. I like to joke that Duke of Cambridge tart was predates Bakewell tart, right?
Yes,
is that what you're
saying?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So you always sort of adjust a recipe to suit modern taste, would you say?
I think we have to move with modern times. I think it's really, really important to. I think that's how a lot of these recipes came about in the first place, adapting to modern times. So what I've done here with the Cambridge Burnt Cream is just adapted it to the modern time a little bit. I like the cold, unctuous, luxurious flavour of a good set cream, and that has to be really creamy. However, I do struggle a little bit with the ratio of caramel to custard in some dishes and all this sort of stuff. So what we've done the caramel separate to the custard, and we've gone with a lot more caramel because I wanted a really, really rich custard. So those two things really balance each other out. It's all about the ratio of bitterness versus luxurious unctuousness.
Yes, I would totally agree. It looks like an amazing sort of caramel top hat.
But what we don't do is, as history would say, is take the crest of Trinity and press it into the
yes,
and caramelise it on the top. We don't do that because, we're not Trinity College.
No.
And do you know what I love about Cambridge Burnt Cream is the beautiful crunch. Do you want to hear it?
Ooh, yes.
Should we hear a crunch?
Go on. Yes.
We get it. Now, that is satisfying, isn't it?
Wow. And it just splintered perfectly.
Yeah. It's, wow. Well, food's got to be fun as well. And I think that's a big part of the fun.
And we hear some of the fascinating history about cafes from Fitzbillie's Tim Haywood.
We started digging back into the history of cake shops, and it's absolutely astonishingly weird, and it's kind of an untold story, but basically of immigrants in the UK by number was Germans and Austrians, and there were sort of four major businesses that they pretty much took over. One of them was German bands. Dance bands, because before we had pipe music and jukeboxes and record players even, every pub had to have a band, and these bands of German sort of umpath players would travel from pub to pub to pub to pub and other places where sort of large groups of working class people would hang out, and they'd play this sort of dance music. And if you think about our image of you know, Victorians having a high old time, the good old days, it always has that kind of kind of polka dance music, and I'd never realised what that sort of German connection was. And then sugar refineries. So the big sugar businesses were all run by Germans. One of the largest ones was run by Stephen Fry's dad.
Really?
In Norfolk. Yes. Oh, a bizarre thing. That's where Stephen Fry's family came from, where they were the German sugar manufacturers. Because they had the science, they had the technology, and you know, it was one of the things that they did better than us in the Industrial Revolution. And then there was, weirdly, cake shops and bakeries. And the Germans had taken over the cake shop and bakery business, and they were doing it brilliantly. They were fantastic. They had a great tradition of bakery, but it wasn't sort of Ponzi or French range or anything like that. And then suddenly, 1914, we have the biggest civil unrest in the UK in history. We effectively, I mean, it's wrong in one way, I suppose, to compare it to Kristallnacht, but we have, in every major city, we have people putting bricks through the windows of any business that sounds German, Austrian, Czech, or any of the other enemy powers. And this happened over the first 2 years of the war regularly. And these things were huge. And people were sort of dragged out of their beds and beaten up, and people had to be arrested for their own safety. Then they start internment. But effectively, all of the German businesses stop dead in 1914. And so a lot of the high street cakeries just shut down, stone dead in 1914, which is a really weird thing. And we can't actually nail it specifically to Cambridge. We don't know if there were riots in Cambridge. We haven't been able to find it out. But there was such a strong element of anti-German feeling that these cake shops all closed down. Coming back from the war, you've got completely deserted high streets. There have been no men for a long time. So many businesses have collapsed. And people are, a lot of guys are coming back with their demob money. And they have this tremendous, you know, entrepreneurial spirit. This is a country fit for heroes. You know, we fought for this. We're going to come back. We're going to do our thing. And they were looking, a lot of them were looking to set up businesses. And the businesses they were able to set up, obviously there was a requirement for high street bakeries. The companies that made bakery equipment and sold flour were really, really keen to finance these guys. And so it was quite easy, particularly if, as the Mason brothers did, their dad had been running a confectioner's in Cambridge anyway, through the war. They were straight up for it. So the Mason brothers started out Fitzbillies on their demob money into an environment that effectively, you know, needed this really badly. Very weirdly, the other business that was really, really heavily pushed to returning soldiers was fish and chips. The manufacturers and, weirdly, the potato farmers and the large fish organisations who'd been very organised, these were people largely who'd been reserved occupations and hadn't gone to war. When these guys came back, of course, we can grow retail, we can grow the sales of this stuff really heavily. So those businesses all took off like a rocket.
I mean, that really is interesting. There's some of the history of cafes. I didn't know that they were mostly owned by Germans and they all shut down at the beginning of the First World War. And the fact that fish and chip shops, by and large, sprung up after the First World War.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows?
Our national dish, help.
And it also occurs to me that Tim Haywood, although he doesn't sort of present himself as such, is actually really quite an expert in food history. Mm. There was that book he wrote, God, I can't remember, it's called, we featured it on Flavour, so this is Unforgivable. But it's the one that came out after Knives, and it was about kitchen design, kitchen utensils, how they're designed as well. And it's all food history, but I don't associate Tim with food history. I associate him with Fitzbillies, with his restaurant reviews in the Financial Times. But actually, he's a food history expert as well.
He's very knowledgeable, very much so.
Yeah. Anyway, our humble exploration of food and drink history here on Flavour extended to a very well-known beer. Here are Rita and Jacob at Rice Boat in Newnham Road.
We didn't initially have any of the mainstream Indian Cobra Kingfisher beers, but customers asked for Indian beers.
Yes.
Plus, we know Lord Billy Moria, the founder of Cobra. So, yes, shouldn't make that much
difference. And in a way, we're supporting a local Cambridge boy who started Cobra.
Oh, really?
Yes, he was studying here at Cambridge.
Lord Billy Moria came here as a student in Cambridge, and he found that many of the Indian restaurants didn't have proper beer that would go well with Indian food. So whilst he was a student, he started sort of researching this and eventually established Cobra.
He used to go around in his car delivering to all the Bangladeshi restaurants in Cambridge. And he's the entrepreneur in residence at the Judge as well.
Judge Business School, yeah.
So he does come to Cambridge still, and his eldest boy just graduated.
That's nice.
Let's move on to the Grafton Centre now. Now, they had a complete overhaul in the last year or so. They devoted a section of their site to what's called Food Social. Now, this is about bringing independence into the mall. And one such independent that we featured back in May was Amelie Flumkouche. This is run by a father and son team, Regis and Alex Creppy. And here is Alex.
Cambridge itself loves to have chains. Makes it a little bit more difficult for smaller people to come in.
With the goal of making Flumkouche a household name, Alex and his father searched 150 sites around England before settling on Cambridge, and a new initiative set up by the Grafton Centre to welcome in independent food businesses.
We had the opportunity with this unit where they didn't really want to trust us, and they felt like independence would be a good side, especially on this side of Cambridge, and we thought we'd go for it, really. So originally we were actually thinking of opening maybe something meaty, but Flumkouche kept on coming up, and we had this passion for Flumkouche. We love the idea of this flatbread that's a lot lighter than pizza, but a lot of flavour still. It's a little bit healthier. You don't feel bloated afterwards because there's no yeast in it.
So like a pizza, but not actually a pizza. This is made with dough rolled very, very thin, and it cooks rapidly. They therefore translate Flumkouche as French firebread.
So I'm going to make a Flumkouche. I'll make the authentic, which is the most traditional one that we have. We start off with the base, flour, water, a little bit of rapeseed oil, and nothing else. There's no yeast or anything. After that, I've put on creme fraiche, seasoned a bit of salt and pepper, and it's a low-fat creme fraiche as well. Low fat's always better, cooks better, and is a lot lighter on your body. Next, we have some very thin smoked bacon. We spread that all on top. Unlike pizza, which was very much on a tomato base in the Mediterranean, these completely different flavours. And this is a very rustic dish from Alsace and kind of went dead for a while and is now starting to be rejuvenated, especially in France, Germany, Austria. It's very, very popular over there. And then finally, we cover it with a bit of Gruyère cheese. Gruyère being a bit sweeter than your traditional cheddar, a bit more flavour than mozzarella. And that's it. That is literally the authentic.
Okay.
Goes in the oven, cooks for 90 seconds, and it's with you from ordering it to it being in front of you. We're looking at not more than 3 minutes.
Lovely. Thank you very much, Alex.
Thank you very much.
Now, that dough is the thickness of a cream cracker. There's a variety of toppings that you can choose from, such as prawn, spinach and ricotta, parma ham, pulled pork. They all come with creme fraiche, onion, olives, tomatoes, etc. And there are plenty of veggie options too. Amelie Flumkouche are on the second floor, just outside the cinema of the Grafton. The reason for Amelie is actually named after his sister, who is called Amelie, and that's why I was playing the Amelie music underneath.
And I try them and they're gorgeous.
They are, aren't they?
Well, we're looking back at 2019 here on Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio. Last year, we heard from writers like Felicity Cloak, had a regular essay from Laura Donoghue, and we also heard from Sarah Lavelle of Quadrille about some superb books. Let's begin this section of the programme with an extract from Laura Donoghue's essay on the subject of apricots.
Close to the end of our stay in Montpellier, Kitty and I visited a farmer's market under the ancient aqueduct, and there we found a stall dedicated to apricots, mounds of them, sold by the people who grew them 6 miles outside Montpellier. These were voluptuous larger fruits, very ripe, perfect at that moment. They were sold by the kilo in slatted wooden baskets by people with stained hands and worn t-shirts who seemed anxious to sell. This was their livelihood, and it would be a bad day if they had to load those apricots back onto the truck to take home again. Despite our impending departure next day, I bought a greedy basket, not realizing it weighed over 2 kilos, until I'd negotiated payment with my halting French. I was struggling with my camera, 2 bijou barquettes of raspberries, and a bottle of rosé from a small winemaker to drink with our last night's dinner. So Kitty took custody of the apricots. We ended up walking for another few hours in the beating sun, having stumbled across a food festival in the park with white-headed chefs displaying their wares under white tents to gentlemen in summer suits and ladies in pretty frocks. By the time we'd been waylaid by that genteel spectacle and a glacé stand, I think even Kitty felt the weight of apricots as this side of burdensome. While she flew back to the States next day, I got my apricots home to England in my carry-on, wrapped individually in tissue, protected with a fortress fashioned from cardboard scraps. They made it better than hoped. Those in best shape were eaten au naturel. The ones that arrived a little sore for their travels were turned into jam according to plan. The jam gods were with me. It was a perfect batch. It was, of course, sublime fruit, so I could have done almost anything and it would have been beautiful. But I'm sure it was also to do with the memories that kept me company as I made it. The thought of those who had grown the apricots and picked them and hauled them to market. The gratitude to Kitty for toting them on her back all day. The mental picture I carry with me of that first childhood tree that started my love affair with apricots and all things that grow. And of course, the anticipation of how good that jam would taste on a proper baguette with real butter. The little meal I think I'd choose over any other for my last on earth.
Really wonderful essays, these, from Laura Donoghue, aren't they? We're lucky to have her, really, aren't we?
I think we are. I think we are indeed, yeah.
Well, now, here are two books that we featured this year. First, an interview with Felicity Cloke of The Guardian and New Statesman on her book, One More Croissant for the Road.
And then I thought, well, I'm going to leave myself enough time. I've got a Michelin star meal booked for my birthday, the only starred restaurant I went to on the trip. I've been planning this for a while. And it was in a sort of suburb of Paris. And I booked a sort of cheap budget hotel relatively nearby. So I thought, I'll give myself enough time. I'm going to have a shower, proper shower, first time in, you know, that's not in a campsite where you keep having to push the water every 30 seconds. You know, I maybe paint my nails. It's a big deal. And the road, the I think Google told me that it would take me, I don't know, an hour and a half to get to this hotel. And I think it took me in the end 4 hours. It was dreadful. It was on the worst roads because it was the main road into Paris or a canal which wasn't paved. And, you know, I was on basically a road bike, so that wasn't ideal. The drivers had become very rude by that point because it was going into Paris. The weather was terrible. I ran out of water. I arrived, I think, 45 minutes. I arrived at the hotel. I got lost. I arrived at the hotel, which was on a massive sort of ring road near an IKEA, 45 minutes after my restaurant reservation. I sort of rang them up, got their answer phone, was crying down the phone, apologising. You know, flung on some different non-cycling clothes, didn't have time for anything, got there, you know, got lost in roadworks on the way, was crying more, arrived there, total mess, you know, honestly, the person you wouldn't let into their restaurant, and the place was full. They were actually turning some people away, and I thought, oh, they've definitely given up my table. And they couldn't, they were so welcoming, they were lovely, they didn't bat an eyelid that I was sitting there with wet hair, creased dress, you know, just looking real, you know, bike oil all over my legs. And they said, don't, you know, what would you like, madame? And I said, yeah, I'd like a glass of champagne and a big bottle of Badoit water. And they appeared as if by magic. I had the nicest meal. I think I must have mentioned it was my birthday, because I think I said when I got the champagne, to justify this extravagance. And they brought me my pudding, which was some little Paris breast and pastries. They put a sparkler in it, everyone in the restaurant said, looked slightly bemused. It was so nice. And as I left, I went to pay the bill and I said, I said to Madame, you know, thank you for this. You made me so welcome because I was on my own on my birthday. And she came round from behind her little desk, which obviously is a big deal, and gave me a hug and a kiss and said, but you weren't on your own, you were with us. And I honestly started crying again. I was like, oh my word. So that was, you know, it was the worst day, but also it showed me the incredible kindness of people. And yeah, I felt better. I felt better at the end of the birthday than I had at the beginning.
Yeah, that was Felicity Cloke talking about her book, One More Croissant for the Road, in which she went round France really looking for the perfect croissant. A really good book. Have you seen
lovely,
it?
Lovely travels, yes, lovely stories.
Yeah, and so really nice person to interview as well. We met in an open square, Granary Place, actually, you know,
oh, King's Cross.
King's Cross, yeah. It was a good place. And another book that we talked about was with Sarah Lavelle. She's the publishing director at Quadrille Publishing. And we talked about several books with her. You know, they do have some very good books. One of them, which really took my attention because I I bake sourdough bread in a very limited manner, was Super Sourdough by James Morton, from whom I could learn a lot.
Sourdough has just exploded in terms of popularity. I mean, it's everywhere. If you go into a cafe these days and have toast, it's going to be sourdough, isn't it? And it's so complex in terms of flavour. I think people become quite obsessed with it, you know. People are very competitive and they challenge themselves and they want to do the best sourdough. It's very Instagrammable. So it's just become this almost like a cult food stuff. And things can go wrong. And so what James wanted to tackle in Super Sourdough is basically how to turn out perfect sourdough loaves and to understand the process so that if it doesn't work out quite right, you know what you might have done wrong and change it for next time. And I tried, lucky enough to be at the photo shoot, and tried most of the things he made, and they were amazing. I mean, all his breads are amazing. Again, he's a brilliant tester of recipes, and I'm sort of in awe as to his skills with bread.
And here's news of free food available now, Saturday, in Cambridge. You can find this information on the Olio app. If you're listening to a repeat or to the podcast, check the Olio app for what's currently available. The app is free to download.
Yeah, so let's look at some Olio news now. Sarah is giving away some fresh rosemary, beautifully presented in a seemingly presentation-like jar. She can also give away as many or as few branches as you like. Now, she lives on Edward Street, which is actually just a road away or two from us at the 105 station. And next up is Karishma. She has some self-raising flour to give away, roughly 1 to 1.5 kilograms, past its best before date, but still in fine condition, she says. And she also has a packet of quick yeast, never opened. Karishma is based near Pound Hill behind Cambridge Market. And finally, Claire has a bag of chestnuts. She tried them, she doesn't like them. She can leave them on her doorstep for you. Claire is based in Comberton near the Village Hall. And that is just a few of the things available today on the Olio app.
Oh, I could fancy the chestnuts. There's another free app called Too Good To Go, which several food outlets in and around Cambridge use. And on that, they sell any unsold goods they have shortly before they close, and they're at knockdown prices.
And we've looked at a few community aspects of food this year on Flavour. One person who has done a lot for both the food community and the food eating community is Heidi White, with both Eat Cambridge and Food Park. She explained in October why she's giving up Food Park.
It was just after we'd hosted the first Eat Cambridge festival that I had the idea to put together some kind of street food scene for Cambridge. I was cramming in quite a lot at that stage, with Eat Cambridge being such a huge thing and going so well, and it really got people's appetite going for that kind of independent food. So I just started putting feelers out, really, to find land that we could do some kind of street food activity on. But I'm having another baby, and logistically I couldn't see how it would work fitting it all in. So this second baby's due in a few weeks' time, 4 weeks' time, and we'll probably be getting a lot more attention than the first one did while I have a little break, which will be really, really nice. And I'll still be taking some time to run Eat Cambridge on the side as well. So it will just be really nice to focus.
Yes, but Food Park does live on in the more than capable hands of Becca Chong, who we also heard from on Flavour during the year. And there's an opportunity to take part in some community food history in and around Cambridge, if you want to. We spoke with Monica Askey from the Orchards East project about their work. Do contact them via their website if you want to be involved.
Yes, it's called Orchards East. It's a just over three-year project, which comes to an end in August next year, funded by the Heritage Lottery Fund. Based at UEA in Norwich, it covers six counties, so Cambridgeshire is one, and it's concerned with a whole range of things to do with orchards. There's an oral history project, there are orchard surveys to see where the orchards were on around about the 1905 ordnance survey maps, and to see what still exists. Then there's a further stage of surveys which is looking into all the biodiversity, so it's looking into things like insect populations, mosses, lichens, that sort of thing. There's the culinary side of it, which is my bit. I've done several things to do with that. I've done cookery demonstrations with tastings at Apple Days. Another aspect of the project, of course, is keeping orchard skills alive. Things like propagating, so grafting, orchard management, pruning, how to manage the trees.
And allotments can be an important part of the community feel as well, and there's several of them in Cambridge. Last July, a series of cooking demonstrations were held at various allotments in the city, cooking with ingredients picked fresh from the plots that day before a seated audience basking in the summer sunshine. Here's one of those demonstrations with a voice that may be familiar to listeners.
Trying to get more veg in our diets, we know it has a health benefit, but also we know that a lot of greenhouse gas emissions contributing to climate change are associated with meat and dairy. So what we're trying to do is inspire you to cook more veg at home, maybe get a plot of your own, grow some veg, and get more veg in your diets. So
I'm making burgers
session.
And chips.
Yeah, that's it. Deep fried and lots of meat.
Cue the inimitable Tristan Welch from Parker's Tavern.
Thank you very much for coming, everyone. Now, I had an idea what I'd like to cook before I came here, and it's completely and utterly changed. When you have these wonderful ingredients in front of you, it's very difficult not to be completely inspired, especially the lovely broad beans, some lovely sprouting broccoli that's just flowering actually as well, which is wonderful. Some marge too as well, and I love these marge too. They're so crispy and fresh. So what I thought I'd do is just a dish where we just crush the broad beans and then we mix it with some olive oil, some cider vinegar, something for a bit of acidity. And I thought, oh, maybe put that rhubarb actually, because it's quite tart and all that sort of stuff. And it tastes like one of those fruity vinegars raw anyway. So I thought we'd put it all together on a nice bit of grilled sourdough that's rubbed with some of this elephant garlic. It's the biggest garlic
absolutely
you've ever
enormous
seen.
Is it stronger than normal garlic?
I find elephant garlic lighter. In fact, I was told it's part of the leek family.
Yeah,
you knew. Yeah. Well, I knew,
yeah. Obviously, no one else did.
No one else did. No, I absolutely did not know. Well, this is really a fancy beans on toast. Some onions and some garlic. And we'll start sweating that down in olive oil.
Sprinkle those out there.
And funny enough, if you put salt in onions when they start cooking, it makes them a little bit sweeter, which is really interesting, I always think. I'm going to add our beans to that. Right, pop our garlic in there as well. It's got a lot of natural sweetness in from the marsh too, the broad beans. So into this goes our broccoli and our marsh too. Just for a second, just to start the cooking off.
Oh, it's so pretty.
I'm a firm believer of not overcooking green vegetables.
Are you a fan of a broad bean at Parker's Tavern?
God, you know, the chefs are fed up with me at the moment, because at Parker's Tavern there's broad beans on blooming everything.
Really?
But they're so lovely, and you know, we are as seasonal as we possibly can be, and as local as we possibly can be. Yeah. And this is the kind of thing I do at home. When I say that, I mean, I don't have a recipe and I don't know, and I change my mind quite often. Now, just keeping the shape of the rhubarb, but cutting it as thin as you possibly can. Only a little bit of this stuff, because you know, rhubarb is quite tart and quite acidic, but it really does remind me of raspberry vinegar. What grows together goes together. Everything growing here in this allotment, the proof's in the taste, isn't it? Right, so all those flavours are crushing into it now, but if everyone's going to taste it, I have to taste it as well, just to make sure it's good. It's fine. And there we are. That is the fanciest beans on toast you've ever seen. And you know what the nice thing is? It'll be different next week. Yeah. You come here, if you cook the same dish, you'll pick something different. Maybe the courgettes are a bit better. Maybe the broad beans haven't cropped so well that week. I would just like to say thank you very much all for coming at the Rock Allotments for picking up the most amazing, fabulous produce. And things like that are the reason I got into cooking in the first place. So it's just an absolute pleasure to come here and do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Have a lovely taste.
You know, those cookery demonstrations were all part of a collaboration with the Cambridge Veg Fest, which was running at the time. I think it was charged with encouraging people to grow, cook, and eat more local seasonal veg. Now, there are plenty of green-fingered initiatives in and around Cambridge, and one with particularly deep roots in the community is Transition Cambridge, who, again, they want to inspire us to grow, to reuse and adapt. And we have featured plenty of their activities over the years. Thought it was worth just giving them a brief mention here once again. You can find out all about them on their website, transitioncambridge.org.
And a different sort of community story now as we look back to 2019. This one can encourage good health. We spoke with Giles Yeo about his book Gene Eating and discovered all sorts of interesting things. And this is a book which you can rely on, by the way. Giles is a bona fide University of Cambridge researcher and not a make-it-up-as-you-go-along food faddist. People talk about some foods as using up more energy in eating them than they give you. In other words, you can reduce your weight by eating these foods. Celery, for example. Is that true?
Celery, famously a negative calorie food, which means that it could possibly take you more calories to digest it than it actually has. Now, it's apocryphal. It's a myth. That being said, a medium stick, a normal stick of celery only contains 6 available calories to you or me. So it's positive, but really barely. But the interesting thing about caloric availability is if you take that raw stick of celery, which has 6 available calories, and say you chop it up and put it into a stew, you suddenly manage to get out 30 calories. And that's a 5 times increase in exactly the same food just by cooking it. And so showing that, you know, cooking something actually increases its caloric availability. But no.
Some diets suggest not cooking food, don't they? They suggest eating raw vegetables, raw uncooked fruit, mm-hmm. for example.
Yep.
So presumably that's quite good as far as weight loss is concerned.
Okay. Once again, we have to be careful. Now, clearly, the vast majority of vegetables and fruit can and probably should be eaten largely raw. Because you probably do keep a lot of the micronutrients that can be damaged by heat, such as vitamin C, okay? And you can actually get a lot of benefit from that and get a lot of benefit from the fiber that actually eating it. And as I pointed out, if you cook something, you actually break down some of the fiber, which is not a major problem, but it does increase the caloric availability. So you do end up getting a few more calories. That being said, something like carrots, for example, okay, yes, carrots are delicious raw. I like carrots raw. But cooking them actually makes the antioxidants in carrots more bioavailable, meaning that you can actually get them more of it. So while eating the carrots raw is good for you, if you want to get the antioxidant benefit to it, the beta-carotene, for example, then what you want to do is you probably want to steam the carrots. Spinach is something else. Spinach, you see Popeye, you know, Popeye the Sailor Man. Spinach is really high in iron, and that's fine. That's only true, actually, if you cook it and squeeze a bit of lemon juice on it. If you actually eat spinach raw, the vast majority of the iron in spinach is biologically unavailable. So in other words, you eat it, you poop it out the other side. So fine, eat an apple raw, eat an orange raw, eat a banana raw. So you have to understand what you're eating rather than have a blanket a rule about what you're actually eating, right. I think.
Community orchards now. Now, these have become a big thing because, well, this country used to provide plenty of its own fruit, like nuts, apples, cherries, plums, greengages. And Burwell opened its first community orchard in 2019. And this time last year, I went to the Trumpington Orchard to attend the Trumpington Wassail, which was in celebration of the apple. Now, there were plenty of people happy to be out celebrating in the freezing cold that day. I think perhaps the hot mulled apple juice helped. The Trumpington Orchard Wassail brings together the local community. And after some storytelling, everyone forms around the oldest apple tree, called the King Tree.
You start with the King Tree.
Well, it's giving an offering to the tree. It's kind of like saying thank you for what you did for us last year with the apples.
It's an apple tree that's grown from a pip. It's an old sport. And we didn't actually know it was there till we cleared back some of the cherry trees.
And we're going to give you a little bit of sustenance in the middle of the winter.
We decorate it and we pour apple juice around the ground to encourage it, you know, to grow well and have a good crop.
And now we should honour this ancient tree, which has stood for many a year and borne apples for those who came before us. the ancestral tree of the land, the King Tree. We shall give it its offerings.
That's Nigel Pennick, a central character to the Trumpington Wassail. He is the Lord of Misrule.
I come from the land of cocaine. I bring with me all good things, all fruit in abundance. I call upon the spirits of the land to bring us what we need. Let the music commence. Let the wassail begin. Hip hip!
Hooray!
Hip hip!
Hooray!
Hip hip!
Hooray!
We're very lucky because Nigel Pennick, Lord of Misrule, is a very enthusiastic folk musician and he comes and leads the music every year.
Well, Susanna just told me that everything is built around you.
Well, no, I mean, it's the orchard is the main thing, and it's the trees. Let us be. Let everyone lift up the cup and health to the apple tree.
How you guys can play in this cold? My hands have already frozen up.
We're okay. What I do like to see at these events, though, is at one wassail I went to, they use black powder shotguns, and a couple of gamekeeper chaps fire them up into the air. And the idea being you want to stir up the apple gods, and then you also want to banish the evil spirits. But it would be a bit scary to fire off guns in the edge of Trumpington on a Sunday afternoon, I think.
We have had party poppers in the past.
Party poppers?
Because, I mean, it's making a bang, making a loud noise. Yeah. It's like driving away the evil spirits. Yeah, that's what it's about. Drums and...
Rough music.
That's right. Rantantanning. But that's right. That's driving someone out of town as well, that is. Yeah. That's a different kind of thing.
Happy New Year! How are you?
Well, it is a happy new year. It's a happy new growing year, isn't it?
OK, we're going to process now. After everyone's put their toast on the tree.
I think the concept of making a toast actually comes from the wassail.
And I got speaking to someone who sold herself as the chicken lady, and the chicken lady told me that the hanging toast in the tree tradition is the where we get toasting from, as in to toast a drink with someone. I found a good tree to hang my toast in, and yeah, it's very enjoyable.
What's going on in the tub here? We're gonna bob for apples?
Oh, no. This is an old English wassail bowl.
Ooh.
Anybody for apple juice, please come and get seconds.
There's loads.
I really don't want to drink all week, so please come and take it.
I'd ought to bring up the volume a little.
You will sing like a bird.
I hold the holly, the life most jolly.
Some sounds of slurping.
Ah, lovely.
It's not too alcoholic.
And if you fancy a bit of firelight noise and cheery singing, this year's Trumpington Wassail will be on Sunday the 12th of January at 2:30 p.m. Full details are on their website at trumpingtonorchard.org.
And there's the music signalling time for the latest food tweets from the city.
Yes, not so many tweets today, but Calverley's Brewery have tweeted, as they usually do. They're open, and tonight Al Chili are serving, and that will be from 6 till 9 p.m. Jigsaw Bakery in Linton is open after the Christmas and New Year break from 11 until 2 o'clock today. That's Saturday, so you haven't got much time. You've got less than 10 minutes. The Queen's Head in Newton tomorrow has its first roast of 2020. There's a January offer at Parker's Tavern, a January sale, in fact. It starts on Monday, the 6th of January. Two courses for £14, three for £18. That's every Monday and Friday for a while, from 12 o'clock until 5:30. And some extremely good news from Van der Lyle. They're going to be offering lunch on two dates in March. That's the 7th and the 21st. And booking for that is now open. I suppose the ultimate producer of all this lovely food and drink we talk about is the earth. And Steve Thompson, the foraging chef, has been our guide to what it produces when left to its own devices. Here is Steve talking about what can be done with your forage findings.
What's looking better this year, however, is the elderberries. So they're just starting to ripen up now. If you start looking up some plants, the ones that are in full sun all day, they'll be ripening now. The other ones probably a week or two away. And what we're going to do with those is lacto ferment. lacto-fermenting is turning the natural sugars in the berries into lactic acid, which is the preservative. So we basically do is we make a 3% brine, so that's 3% salt to the water, make sure everything is completely sterile, and then pour that over the elderberries, and then we leave them to sit for about 3 months.
As simple as that?
Yep. You have to go there every day and just give them a little burp, so you let rid, basically, that that's letting go of all the carbon dioxide that they release.
So would it be a good idea to, say, use kilner jars or something like that?
Yeah, something like that would be good. Yeah, that's the easiest way. And then after that, once you'll be able to see when the fermentation stops, when the bubbles stop, and then you can store them in the fridge or however you like.
Do you have to keep them in the dark or the light, or does it matter?
I find it's better, yeah, to keep it not necessarily in the dark, but out of straight, direct sunlight. So we'll keep them in our dry stores and things like that. So I don't find they work on the windowsills.
And how long would they keep for once the fermentation has finished?
In theory, they're preserved. So they should keep for as long as you need them to.
And then when you use them, you don't need to top up the brine or anything like that?
No, you don't want anything to become uncovered. But as you're taking out the berries, you shouldn't be getting down to a level where it's low enough. You want to make sure everything's covered when you do it originally. Yeah, because if you start to get things poking out the top, then they will start to go bad. And there's a few other signs. It's best to do your research before you do it and check what you need to know to be able to ferment.
You use the internet or a book for that?
Yeah, the internet's a good source, but you have to remember that anyone can write on the internet.
True.
And you don't always trust everything you see. I'd say books are a lot more safer. Mm. There's a very, very affordable one, actually, written by Noma, the Danish restaurant on fermenting, and I think it's only about £20. It goes into it in a lot more depth, but it does still have the basics in there to get you started, and that's quite a worthwhile book to get, I'd say.
So it's not every year we get a new specialist independent food shop providing us with food of really high quality, but in 2019 Meadows opened in Elstersley Avenue.
Yeah, so she has an amazing selection of almonds, pistachios and walnuts, again from Greece. Greece is a great resource in Europe, which we probably underestimate a little bit because Spain and Italy tends to reach us first. But a lot of the farming there has never altered from traditional methods of farming, and so remains very much organic. And so for organic ingredients of really good quality, it's a real go-to place.
Right, so is that where the olive oil presumably comes from,
so
there as well?
Yeah, she has a couple of different pressings. So the 18 degrees is the first pressing, pressed at cool temperatures. Right. You get a really, really intense flavour from the oil. And then the 22 degrees is a little later in the harvest, higher temperatures, so it's a little bit lighter.
Thundering into Green Onions and the start of our new section, we begin with jobs.
Mill Road Butchers is opening a bakery just outside Cambridge, and they're looking for a baker who can bake bread and cakes. Send your CV to cambridgemillroadbutchers@gmail.com, and you can phone them for further information on Cambridge 354 779.
The Holiday Inn in Impington wants a commis chef and a chef de partie. Apply via the LGH Hotels Management website. Please let them know you heard about the vacancy here on Flavour.
And if you have a vacancy that you'd like to advertise in this slot, then please email sales@cambridge105.co.uk.
Cambridge businesses are gradually reopening after the holiday break. The Farmers Outlet Store in Lensfield Road is opening on Monday. Oak Bistro next door opens on the 8th of January, which I think is Tuesday. Meadows and Eltersley Avenue will be opening its doors again on the 9th of January. Ben's Fish Van returning to Grantchester Street on the 11th. And Emerald Foods, their marvellous market stall, are open today, but then they're closed until the 24th of January for a holiday.
And there's also a new Turkish restaurant called Yakut that's opened in the Grafton Centre's food social area, adding to their list of independent food offerings. And some very good news now from Mark Poynton. He will be cooking at the Cambridge Cookery in Purbeck Road every Friday and Saturday night. On Fridays will be a three-course meal, the cost of £40, while Saturday will be a five-course tasting menu for £55. And you can book for those via the Cambridge Cookery School website.
News about courses now at Cambridge Wine Merchants in Cherry Hinton Road, and you can take a day-long Level 1 WSET course. Two available dates in January, 11th and 13th. Cost is £165 and you can book via the Cambridge Merchants website. The tutor on that course is Steve Hovington, well known to regular listeners of Flavour, and he's got a tasting session also at Cambridge Wine Merchants in Cherry Hinton Road on the 22nd of January. It's tips on what to drink in 2020, new trends, new styles, up-and-coming wine regions, rising starts, that sort of thing, and you get to taste wines. Cost is £22.50 and details are on the Cambridge Wine Merchants website. Plus, Cambridge Distillery in Grantchester has gym masterclasses every day from Monday to Saturday, 3 to 1 on Sundays. Book via their website.
And that's all from our look back at 2019. We'll be here on alternate Saturdays at 1 with fresh features and the latest food news. We'll be repeated on Sunday at 2 and podcast early in the next week.
And coming up on Cambridge 105 Radio today is the Eclectic Light Show, looking back on last year's Cambridge Folk Festival. At 5 o'clock, it's another edition of Polish Waves, bringing Polish and English culture closer together. And then at 6, it's From the Terraces, reviewing the latest footballing action from Cambridge United, City and Histon Town. The Big Band Show is on at 7, and at 8, it's Let the Good Times Roll. Rebel Arts Radio is on at 9 o'clock, followed by Stagger at 10, and we round off the evening at 11 with Bookmark.
But that's all from us. Flavour will be back on the 18th of January. So until then, goodbye.
Goodbye.